Good news for those coffee lovers among us.
Do we have an oral treatment for RSV, or respiratory syncytial virus?
What is the most reliable way to take somebody's temperature?
And mutations in genes in pediatric cancer.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on November 20th, 2015. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, it's early in the morning, of course, while we're recording. I've had my loading dose of coffee. I hope you have too. Our paper this week in Circulation says it's okay for us to do those kinds of things.
All right, so I haven't had my cup of coffee yet, and after we discuss this, we'll decide how many cups I should have. This particular study looked at this association of coffee consumption with mortality and also cause-specific mortality. They looked at three large prospective cohorts to identify if there was a relationship between coffee consumption and mortality. And the reason they did that is because there's been some controversy. These studies included over 200,000 different men and women, followed for almost 5 million person years. And here's what they found. There was an inverse relationship between coffee and mortality. Those that drank coffee had a lower mortality. There was a decrease in cardiovascular mortality, in suicide, and a decrease in neurologic diseases. And by the way, this was true for whether it was caffeinated or decaffeinated, and there was no association between higher coffee consumption, that is 5 cups or more, and increased mortality. So it looks like somewhere between 1 and 5 cups of coffee, maybe even more, associated with a lower mortality. That's great news.
It's great news. I would say, though, that as we get into those higher coffee consumption categories, the risk of other stuff increases. That would be jitteriness and potentially insomnia, that sort of thing.
You're right. In most things, the excess probably caused some issues. I'd like to stress that this is an association. It's not a cause and effect. But you always look to see if there's some biologically plausible explanation. And coffee contains a number of compounds, things like chlorogenic acid and lignans and quinides, things that we know that decrease the risk of diabetes and are antioxidants. So there is some plausible biologic mechanism behind it as well.
On that note then, Rick, how many cups are you going to have when we finish recording?
At least two.
Yeah, I needed two also. Let's go from here then to Annals of Internal Medicine. Wow, turns out that the way that mom used to take our temperatures way back when may turn out to be the best way to do that.
This was a really interesting study, and I must say, I've never really given it some thought because I just assumed all this had been worked out before. There are several different ways to take someone's temperature. Take a step back and say, well, why is it important to take somebody's temperature? Well, besides just ascertaining where someone has a fever, in the medical field, it determines whether antibiotics are started or blood cultures are obtained, whether we initiate certain types of treatment. So the ascertainment of correct temperatures has clinical implications. And the gold standard is using an intravascular temperature in the bloodstream, and that's the most accurate way. There are other ways called measuring core temperature, a rectal thermometer, a thermometer in the bladder if someone has a catheter in, or if someone has a nasogastric tube, measuring it in the esophagus. Those measure core temperatures, and there are other things that measure peripheral temperatures, devices put in the ear to measure the eardrum temperature, or an oral thermometer, or an axillary in the armpit, or even a new technique called temporal artery. Those are all peripheral. The question is, are they accurate or not? And I thought that would have been asked and answered already, but it hasn't. So what these investigators did, they looked at all the prospective studies that compare the accuracy of these peripheral ways of measuring versus the more central or vascular methods. And what they discovered was the peripheral ones weren't very accurate. Sometimes they were off by 1 or 2 degrees in terms of measuring temperatures, carry some important clinical implications.
Maybe. And that's what I have to say about that. I'm not sure that there really are important clinical implications unless it either says there isn't a fever or there is. So I think that absolute thing is potentially powerful, but not necessarily the degree.
Okay, so here's what they discovered. At the extremes of temperature, either fever or hypothermia is where they were most inaccurate. Well, that's where you want them to be most accurate. Now, if it said there was a fever, the peripheral thermometer, then you could trust it. The specificity was about 94%. But how sensitive was it? Only about 60%. That is, if it told you there was no fever, well, you really couldn't take it to the bank. I think it has clinical implications, at least in the medical field of patients that I take care of.
Right. So for hospitalized patients, I think that's probably true. But for for people who are just taking their child's temperature in the community, I'm not sure I am persuaded.
Elizabeth, I would agree with you. I think we can summarize it by saying if the temperature will influence the clinical decision, then using a peripheral thermometer is not the way to go.
Okay. Let's move here then to the New England Journal of Medicine. One that I thought was really interesting, so-called germline mutations and their relevance in childhood cancers.
So Elizabeth, why did you pick this particular study?
I am interested in this because I'm always questioning when a child manifests with cancer, is that something that really happened in utero when the egg was fertilized? Was that something that was already set up? Or are there environmental exposures that really give rise to that cancer?
I guess what you're asking is, are these mutations due to the germ cells or are they acquired mutations called somatic mutations? Most adult cancers are due to somatic mutations. The cells undergo some genetic transformation that predisposes individuals to cancer. Kids, conversely, haven't been exposed to many of the environmental issues, and so it may be more likely that their mutations are due to germline issues. So here's what the investigators did. They looked at 1,120 children with a variety of cancers. They did whole genome studies. Then they looked at only the coding parts, called whole exome screening. And then they looked at specific genes that they know are associated with cancer, called candidate gene analysis. They focused on 60 genes that are known to produce cancer in an autosomal dominant fashion. And what they discovered was in the children with cancer, at least 8.5% had germline mutations. Now, I say at least 8.5%. They looked at genes that they know are related to cancer. There are probably many others that we don't even know about yet. This may underestimate the risk of people that have germline mutations. You say, well, what are the clinical implications of this? I think there are several. Although there are many children that may have germline mutations, this doesn't tell us what percentage of them will go on to develop cancer. This doesn't tell us, by the way, whether these were formed in the germ cells or inherited from the parents because they didn't examine the genetic analysis of the parents. Only 40% of these kids had a family history of cancer. So a family history alone isn't a good screening mechanism. And then because many of these kids will be cancer survivors, these genetic mutations can be passed on to their children. This is the most comprehensive study we have yet. Now we need to move to the next step to how to use this clinically.
It's interesting that 1 in 10 kids who have cancer, this was something that started out at essentially fertilization.
Or maybe in their parents. That's the other possibility.
Right. And I think it does have important implications with regard to potential interventions. Because, and maybe it's a long leap, and since I don't do this kind of work, I'll admit this freely, but I wonder what these mutations tell us about what pathways are involved in these kids' cancers.
And that's a really good point. We don't yet know why these genetic abnormalities eventually lead to cancer.
Well, no doubt we're going to be seeing a whole lot more about this. Finally, then, let's turn to something that also affects an awful lot of children, to the New England Journal of Medicine. Respiratory syncytial virus, abbreviated RSV. Do we have something that could potentially intervene?
And globally, RSV infections are estimated to cause about 3.5 million hospitalizations annually and somewhere between 66 and 200,000 deaths. Now, that's mostly in developing countries. There's a lot of morbidity, but not much mortality in the United States associated with this virus, but it's still a really big issue. So the question is, can we find some oral treatment? And there's a particular compound that was studied. It goes by ALS008112. It's taken up by the epithelial cells that line the respiratory tract, and then it inhibits the RSV from replicating. By doing that, it can potentially decrease the viral load. And we know that that viral load is associated with the symptoms. The higher the viral load, the more the symptoms. So this oral medication was tested versus placebo in adults that were specifically infected with RSV. When they began to develop symptoms or blood evidence of an active infection, they were given placebo or this oral medication for 5 days. This oral medication decreased the viral load by 85 to 88% compared to placebo. And by the way, it did it quickly with the first dose. Symptoms were less, and they even measured mucus drainage, Kleenex weight, and there was less mucus drainage as well.
Couple questions about this, of course. I serve this up as a big problem in the pediatric population. We know that kids are not small adults. I wonder about the utility of this particular intervention in kids.
This is a hard study to conduct in kids because, remember, they intentionally infected these individuals. Is this applicable to kids? That's a great question. The next step from here is to take it and test it in a pediatric population. But it certainly looks promising right now.
Of course, I have to ask, what about a vaccine?
In the long run, that would be good. We don't have one available that's as effective as we'd like it to be.
I guess some of the things I'm wondering about are, what are the barriers to the development of an effective vaccine for RSV?
Well, if there were none, we'd have it by now, I can tell you.
Point well taken.
So right now we're left with treating the active disease.
Okay. On that note, of course, I'm going to talk about the coffee, my favorite thing on the blog this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.